You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to this podcast series on the emerging roles of oral SERDs in community care for HR-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. This is the second of a three-episode series offered by Med Learning Group and designed to meet the educational needs of U.S.-based community oncology teams, including oncologists and advanced practice providers involved in the treatment of patients with metastatic disease. My name is Erica Mayer. I am the Director of Breast Cancer Clinical Research in the Breast Oncology Center at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts, and an Associate Professor in Medicine at Harvard Medical School. I'll be the host of today's podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking about biomarker testing for HR-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. I'm honored to have my partner today is my dear colleague, Dr. Aditya Bardia, Professor, Department of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology, and Director of Translational Research Integration Medicine at UCLA Health in Los Angeles, California. Aditya, thank you so much for joining me today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So let's start off with a broad overview of the current common actionable biomarkers that we use for HR-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease, and maybe try to link these to the associated therapies that are unlocked when these mutations are present.
Yeah, absolutely. We are in the era of genotype-directed therapies, and in breast cancer, there are a number of actionable mutations. Focus on hormone receptor positive metastatic breast cancer. The first one would be PI3 kinase. Alpelisib is a drug that's approved for patients who have detectable PIK3CA mutations. Capivasertib is another drug that's approved for patients with PIK3CA mutations that are detectable. Capivasertib is also approved if there are mutations in P10, AKT, so the whole PI3 kinase pathway. So that's actionable. The second bucket would be ESR1 mutations. So these are mutations in the estrogen receptor, the ligand binding domain, the domain where estrogen binds to the estrogen receptor, undergoes a mutation, so it becomes estrogen independent. But drugs that directly bind to ER or selective estrogen receptor degraders, or we call SERDs, work in that setting. And we have two FDA-approved therapies now, elacestrant, imlunestrant. There might be others coming in the future as well. The third bucket would be BRCA mutations or BRCA mutations, both germline as well as somatic. And we have two PARP inhibitors that are approved for germline BRCA mutations, olaparib, talazoparib, although often also used in patients who have somatic BRCA mutations detectable by sequencing. Besides that, there are also certain biomarkers that are approved that are tumor agnostic. For example, NTRK fusions. We have NTRK inhibitors, two NTRK inhibitors that are approved. So in summary, there are various actionable biomarkers, ESR1, PI3 kinase pathway, PARP, also PALB2. Olaparib is a drug that can be used in that setting. And that's why it's important to test for these biomarkers.
Thank you. That's super comprehensive. And it really reminds us that we've come such a long way from the days of just checking estrogen receptor and HER2, and that was kind of all we had to help unlock therapies and help direct care. So now that we have all of these biomarkers that are so intimately linked to their associated therapies, I guess the question that comes up is when and how should we test for them? You know, when is the right time to test? What patient materials are best to use for testing? I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this and how you do this in your practice.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that has evolved over time. If I were to answer this question in 2024, I would have said we should do testing after first line. In the first line setting, we use endocrine therapy plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor for patients with metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer. When patients have disease progression in that setting, biomarker testing is strongly recommended. If there's ESR1 mutation, you can use match therapy, PIK3CA match therapy, and so on and so forth. And because some mutations, particularly ESR1 mutations, are acquired mutations, it's generally recommended that we use blood-based testing so we can pick up these acquired mutations. If we were to sequence the primary tumor, you will miss these mutations. And as per guidelines, blood-based testing is recommended and serial testing is also recommended because these are acquired mutations. You can miss them in the first instance, but if you do serial testing at the time of each disease progression, you're much more likely to pick up these actionable mutations. Now in 2025, we can make a case of even doing mutation testing at the time of metastatic diagnosis. And the reason for that is because now we have a drug, inavolisib, that's approved for patients who have PIK3CA mutant hormone receptor positive breast cancer who had disease progression on adjuvant endocrine therapy. And if they develop metastatic disease on adjuvant endocrine therapy or within 12 months of completion of adjuvant endocrine therapy, the triplet therapy of fulvestrant plus inavolisib plus palbociclib was associated with improvement, not just in PFS, but overall survival as well. And given that we've seen improvement in overall survival, I think it's important to test for these mutations in this setting because that's actionable.
Thank you. That's really important to think about, particularly the kinetics of mutations that evolve over time versus mutations that are there the whole time. What about using tissue versus blood samples? You sort of alluded to this with ESR1. What do you like to do? What's the best source of material to do this type of testing?
So in 2025, my practice now is if a patient has a diagnosis of metastatic disease, we usually get ER, PR, HER2 based on tissue. And at that time, I send for sequencing as well, particularly PI3 kinase, because that could be actionable. And then we start endocrine therapy plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor with without a PI3 kinase inhibitor. At the time of disease progression on first-line therapy, so that second line, I generally prefer blood-based testing because that's how you can pick up acquired mutations like ESR1. And then after that, I essentially resort to blood-based testing at the time of each disease progression. So whatever second-line therapy you use, at some point, if there's disease progression, repeat blood-based testing again, and so on and so forth. So to summarize, in the first line setting, I do tissue-based testing, but then beyond that, it's usually blood-based testing.
Mm-hmm. That's great and very much mirrors what I do in my practice. And I think it's a super important point about shifting the time of initial testing to be when we suspect metastatic disease so that we can unlock inavolisib if that's an option for our patient, as opposed to missing the window if we test too late. So that's terrific. Let's dig in a little bit with ESR1 mutations, as that's really a hot space in breast cancer right now. How do you use the information from ESR1 testing to make clinical decisions? When do you test? And if you are testing and you find a positive ESR1 mutation, what are we going to do about it? What's the right action at that point?
So in general, I do testing in the second line and plus setting. I'll again emphasize the plus setting. It could be third line, it could be fourth line as well. And if ESR1 mutation is detected, there are two FDA-approved therapies to consider. One would be elacestrant, and the second would be imlunestrant. Both of these are approved as monotherapy for patients with detectable ESR1 mutation. So those would be the drugs I would consider. There's some thought about whether these drugs should be used monotherapy versus combination. There are pros and cons to each approach, but at least I'm thinking of an oral SERD if I see ESR1 mutation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's our appropriate linkage. So, you know, over the past couple of years, we've seen some really exciting clinical trial data looking at interesting and really informative ways to use testing to help offer therapies to patients and help try to improve outcomes. And, you know, I'm thinking particularly the idea of using oral SERDs earlier on in treatment or the selection of therapies being guided by our testing results. Could we talk a little bit about some of those new paradigms and new platforms and, you know, what we've learned from the trials that might one day help inform our practice?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are two broad paradigms to consider. The first is if there is ESR1 mutation, we have two oral SERDs, elacestrant, imlunestrant approved, but then there are others coming as well. We've seen data with vepdegestrant or vepdeg in the VERITAC-2 trial. In a similar results, it was superior to standard endocrine therapy in this setting. And at ESMO 2025, Dr. Mir, you presented the results of Avera, which looked at giredestrant plus everolimus, and you could see that the combination therapy was superior to standard endocrine therapy plus everolimus. So more and more evidence building around the use of these oral SERDs in the second line setting and beyond, either as monotherapy or combination therapy. The second paradigm is, can we test for ESR1 mutations when patients are on first line therapy? So first line right now is endocrine therapy plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor. We do routine scans every 2 to 3 months. We check tumor markers 2 to 3 months when patients come in for their visit. Can we actually test for ESR1 mutation in this setting as well? And if we see detectable ESR1 mutation, but no progression on scans, can we switch therapy? So at the time of molecular progression, but not radiological progression, can we switch therapy and is that beneficial? So that question was first evaluated in the PADA-1 study and then the registration phase 3 SERENA-6 trial, which showed that if you switch therapy at the time of detection of ESR1 mutations in the absence of radiological progression, you have better progression-free survival. You have better progression-free survival 2 or PFS2 as well. And more recently, we've seen quality of life data as well, which shows that there's delay in deterioration in symptoms or delay in deterioration of worsening quality of life. So the evidence is building in terms of testing for these mutations, even in the first line setting, because that could potentially be actionable.
Yeah, I think it's very exciting to think about this idea of detection of molecular progression or, you know, a resistance mutation that's kinetic over time. And, you know, obviously this is not an approved regimen yet, so it's not something we're operationalizing yet. But, you know, what are your thoughts on kind of bringing this into clinic and discussing this with patients and using this with your clinical teams? Do you think this will be something fairly straightforward for us to roll out in the breast cancer world?
Yeah, and a good question. It might not be straightforward, but if, you know, this is an important finding, we need to incorporate that. Change is always difficult, but if that's the right thing for patient, as providers, we will ensure that patients have access to both the testing and therapy. So like we do tumor markers, it could be standard of care. Besides looking at CA15-3, CEA, you also look at ESR1 mutations. And many a times we do switch therapy based on markers. And here you have a therapy that's matched to ESR1 mutation. So I think that is potentially, as you were saying, exciting and could change how we use these oral SERDs in this clinical practice. What would be nice to have in the future would be overall survival, because that would essentially, you know, change practice overnight. Some have brought up the point about should we switch early versus late, but if there's improvement in overall survival, that'll put that debate to rest. So look forward to seeing overall survival results from SERENA-6. But till then, if this drug is approved or camizestrant is approved in this setting, I think that is something we need to consider, similar to how we use other therapies in this setting.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, I think what's quite interesting about SERENA-6 is the platform of the serial testing for emergence of mutations. Do you think that this platform or this approach has applicability outside of the oral SERD story, or do you think this is something that we'll adopt into medical oncology practice?
Yeah, absolutely. More the latter. And I think in part that was the reason why SERENA-6 was presented at ASCO in the plenary session, because it has application not just to ESR1 mutation and oral SERD, but for the field in general, the principle of looking at molecular progression and using genotype-directed therapy based on molecular progression. So it could have applicability for PI3 kinase or AKT or mTOR inhibitors, drugs that inhibit that pathway. It could have application outside of breast oncology as well, in lung cancer, in colon cancer, other cancers. So it's truly a paradigm changing or shifting study that could have application in multiple cancers.
Thank you. That gives me some goosebumps thinking about the future for us in medical oncology and all the really exciting advances that are ahead of us in the years ahead. So, you know, thank you so much, Aditya. These are just wonderful points. I think we're out of time at this moment, but I want to thank you so much for your insightful conversation. We've definitely learned a lot. So I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Aditya Vardia, for taking the time to speak to us. And thank you to all of our listeners for joining us. Please join me for our next podcast. Dr. Kevin Kalinske will join me to talk about monitoring and management of toxicities associated with oral endocrine therapy. Additionally, if you haven't already listened to it, please check out our episode number 1, where Dr. Cynthia Ma and I talked about the development of oral endocrine therapies for breast cancer and where the field is heading. Hopefully, you're able to tune in and also explore the many other types of CME programs that MedLearning Group offers. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, who provided the unrestricted grant for this educational activity. Have a great day.